Good morning. So last time we talked about applying the pipelining concept to our single cycle processor. We divided it up into its pipeline stages and we looked at, well, you know, how much faster do we actually make it? And one thing we need to determine is, like, what could our cycle time be? And with our full processor, this was a bit less straightforward than our sort of times three example. And our general mechanism is we look for what we called critical paths. We considered, well, we have signals that need to go from somewhere when the clock cycle starts at that rising edge that triggers, like, registers the change. It needs to go through a bunch of stuff and end up somewhere for the next rising edge for typically input to other registers or other storage components. And each of these paths needs to happen, therefore, in a clock cycle. It's kind of a way of measuring sort of a minimum time the clock cycle needs to be, and one of these is going to take the longest time. Whichever one takes the longest time, that's what we call a critical path. That's going to determine our cycle time. We also talked about, well, we learned that our pipelining processor didn't always quite work. And we had this issue that, well, some instructions depend on the results of another. And sometimes this is fine. Sometimes we have one instruction that's going to produce a result, and then the other instruction is going to read that result just naturally the way our pipeline works. Sometimes that's not true. And the reason why that wouldn't be true is that when we made our pipelining, we changed the order in which the values are read or written. That an instruction can be in the process of computing a value, not having yet written it, and another instruction might want to use that value. So that was an example of a case where our pipeline handled a dependency. We had a dependency between instructions. Sometimes they worked, sometimes they didn't. When it handled them wrong, that was a hazard. And in particular, we talked about data hazards, where our pipeline did something wrong because we were trying to read data before it was actually written. And, well, we need to do something about this. It's not acceptable if our processor just executes programs incorrectly. So we need some sort of solution. And we had a generic solution for hazards, which is that when we have some problem that our pipeline just doesn't work naturally, we can just insert knobs that we can, what we did, said it was stall, that we can say, okay, I can't execute this instruction correctly yet, so let's just wait until I can. We know we can wait because, you know, if we went back to just doing one instruction at a time, we'd get the right answer. So installing, the hardware just waits and inserts knobs while it's waiting. And in this case, well, we get the right answer at least, but we're losing a lot of the benefit of pipelining. That, you know, we went to all this work to be able to run one instruction every cycle with this shorter cycle time. And now, well, we have a shorter cycle time still, but we can't run one instruction every cycle. We've kind of lost most of that advantage, or possibly all of the advantage. And in the case of data hazards, where we were trying to read something that wasn't written yet, we found out we had a solution that often would work better. That, well, often, it turned out that we already had computed that value that we wanted to read. We just haven't written it back yet. But it's computed, we could get it. And our solution that was better than stalling was that, well, we could take the value where it is in the pipeline and send it to replace the value we read that was wrong. We call this idea forwarding. So we have some value that's going to be written, we use it in place of our read. And we're going to talk about that as our main topic for today. So before, got questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so based on the quiz scores, I'm going to go over several of the quiz questions. Start with question one. So question one was saying that we had a pipeline which was divided as we had fetch as our first stage, and then we had decode, execute, memory, write back as our second stage. And was asking what our cycle time could be. We have the lines of components. And basically what we wanted to do here is we wanted to consider sort of all our possible paths and figure out which is our critical path. So, for example, in the fetch stage, We need to get a value from the PC through the instruction memory, through the PC increment logic. And the PC increment logic needs to know the opcode, so critical path includes the instruction memory and that logic. Back to the PC. We also need to get a value from the PC to the instruction memory, to the pipeline registers. In our decode execute memory write back mega stage, we need to get a value from the pipeline registers through the register read, through the ALU, through memory write. That's one possible critical path, or long path. We also need to get a value from the register read, through the ALU, through the memory read, the register write, and that turned out to be the longest path. And that determined the overall time. And some of you might say, well, what about, you know, going through the register read, through the ALU, through the memory write, through the register write? That's longer. Yes, it is, but we never actually send a value from memory write to register write. We don't care about doing that. There's no instruction which will ever do that. We can't use the result of the memory write to write a register. This was not a possible path that we needed to consider. Then you might say, wait a moment, we had push. And the push instruction, doesn't it both write memory and write a register? Yes, it does. But when it writes its register, the way it's doing that is it's taking a value from the pipeline registers, reading some register, and then doing an ALU computation on that, and using the result of that ALU computation to write a register. It doesn't actually rely on sending the value through the memory to write a register. So our critical path ends up being that memory read to register write, but that's the longest we have. We don't have any longer ones. We don't have to ever combine a memory write sort of in the same path as a register write. So questions on that? Yes. Can I go over the difference between the first two candidates? So these are candidates for fetch. So in our fetch stage, we have our PC, which goes into our instruction memory. And out of our instruction memory, we get a bunch of things. And one of the things we do is we fill in our pipeline registers for our next stage, like we have RA and RB, for example. Another thing we do is we take the I code, which we're also going to send to the next stage, and we use that combined with the PC to compute the next PC. So the two first paths I'm representing here are, we have the path through the instruction memory to these pipeline registers, and we have the path through the instruction memory to compute the next PC. I didn't draw all the paths because there's a few others. In particular, there's, you know, I didn't write down that also we need to go from the PC through here because I knew that was short. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's do question three. So question three was saying we had a processor with one stage, single cycle, that took 300 picoseconds. It was asking, let's say we made it 8 stages, how fast, what's the range of speeds it could have? And our ideal case is that we take our 300 picosecond processor, which we assume was, you know, fairly optimized, divide it into 8 equal pieces. We got pieces that take about 375 picoseconds, 3,000 divided by 8. And some register delay, which is hopefully really tiny. So it's basically 375 picoseconds. That's sort of our best case. Our worst case is that whatever work's being done in these 300 picoseconds, there's no good way of dividing it up into stages. So we divide it up into stages, we end up with one of the stages, the longest one, taking essentially 300 picoseconds, in which case we didn't really get anything. The question says there is a performance improvement, so that's sort of our upper bound. We can't like get much better than that. Yes. So the question is, what happens if you put have answers which are like, yeah, trying to be, where you see where you interpret greater than less than, so you greater than one, or you did some other thing like that. We're going to have writers look at it, and we should give credit for the, I made a small adjustment to the actual number because of, I was worried about fence post errors and the like. Yes. Glancing through the list of answers, that was maybe less, that was somewhat common, but not as common as I would have hoped, given the score. The average score. Yes. So the question is, I have all of them, all the stages. So the question is, the question is, you interpreted that as you were talking about how long each stage would take. Yeah, so the question was asking about cycle time, and probably the most important thing about cycle time is you can't set a different cycle time for each stage. You have to set one cycle time. So it doesn't matter that one stage could have a short cycle time. That's not how a processor is ever going to work. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So we consider that a big problem. I consider that a big problem in answering questions like this, because when we're thinking about processors, it's really important that we think carefully about, I need to worry about the worst cycle time in all the stages. You know, so because a big, conceptual mistake you might make is say, oh, I'm going to optimize this stage a whole bunch, and then you'll find out you didn't help your processor at all. Okay. Other questions? Yes?
Will there be like partial credit if you got one of the bounds right?
Will there be partial credit? I'm going to have my TAs decide on a rubric. And I don't know what that looks like yet. I'll see what their proposal is. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so then we have question four, which was asking if we had the boundary between decode and execute, what things go on the pipeline registers? And I think the one which caused people confusion here was about the register indices. And I think the source of the confusion was you said, oh, wait a moment, decode, that's where we use register indices. Well, it's true. We use register indices in decode. We also use them in writeback. So we need to know where to write things. And because we need them in writeback, we need to pass the register indices for writeback through the pipeline, because there's no other way they could get it. And finally, or questions on question four? Okay, then we had question five. So question five was saying we had this logic, which was fetch to decode, execute to memory write back. This is our processor, had these three stages, and was asking how, if something happened in cycle one, when did our write back happen? And to figure this out, I need to figure out when stalling would happen. We said we're using stalling to resolve hazards, not forwarding. So we have a dependency here and a dependency here. There are no other dependencies between these instructions. Yes, we have two instructions that use R8, but they're both reading it. They don't care what it is. We have two instructions that use R10, and one's writing, one's reading, but the one that's reading is reading not a value that's not the one that value that's being written. It's reading an older value. And so what I do is I say, well, our first instruction, we're going to execute normally, so we have our three stages. Our second instruction, we want to fetch right away, and we like to read during the decode stage the value of R9. But to do that, well, I can't read it yet because it hasn't been written until the end of cycle three. So we need to delay that decode stage, do some sort of stalling, in order to actually do that read. So that's why I have one cycle delay, and all the other instructions are delayed because of that. It doesn't matter that they could execute independently. And that satisfies that read, and I look at my next dependency. Well, for the last add reading R9, that's not going to be a problem.
And so I draw out my diagram and I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Cycle 7 is the answer I wrote down. Some questions, how I figure that out? And as you might guess, I strongly recommend making a diagram somewhat like this for answering questions of this sort, rather than like, even though, yes, you don't need to, but usually that is what I find really helps and avoids making mistakes of like saying, oh, there's two dependencies, two stalls, or something like that, which wasn't true in this case because of how they were laid out. Okay, so last time we were looking at forwarding. So we mentioned that our key idea of forwarding, we had this example to start out with, which was that, oh, we have the value of R9, which instruction 2 here needs, that's computed by instruction 1. It's right here, and instruction 1 is in its execute stage, and we can send it to the decode stage of instruction 2, replacing the wrong value that was read. We'll do that by adding a mux, and sending the value in the appropriate time. We also need to do this for reading from register B, and it turns out there's going to be a whole bunch of other cases we're going to need to handle with these muxes, but the general pattern is that we're going to send a value to replace the value we read that was wrong. And in this way, we're going to avoid stalling to wait for the correct value to be written, so we're going to save some time. So we know we're replacing that value. Let's think about how that works. So here, I know that in this case, I want to take my value of R9 from 1 and have it replace the value of 2's register output. And we have a mux that's choosing to do this. So our mux has some code like this here, where we're normally taking the first register output, but in this case we're taking this value from the ALU. This is following the naming convention in our textbook. So to remind you about how that works with pipeline registers. So the inputs to the fetch to decode registers are lowercase f, the outputs are uppercase D. The inputs to the decode to execute registers are lowercase D, the outputs are uppercase E. The inputs to the execute to write back registers are lowercase E, outputs are uppercase W. And so this is E-val-E, because later on it becomes W-val-E, which is the regdest E. So that's why I have E-val-E as sort of the value for this mux when we're not choosing the register file output. And my question here is, well, what should the condition be? And something that I'm kind of giving you here is that, well, the condition is going to be based on which register we were trying to read from. Right? We want to look at, I was trying to read from this register, and we should detect that, no, the actual value I want is elsewhere, based on which register I was trying to read, and I know which register I was trying to read using source A. A few minutes or two, think about what should our condition be. Check with your neighbors, see if you agree on.
Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's see who thinks A, B, C, D, E, no clue. Okay, so we have a split between B, C, and no clue. So let's sort of start how we're way of thinking about this. So we have this evaluate value, this value which came out of the ALU here. And we want to figure out where it's going to go. Well, if we look at our picture here, it's going to go through this pipeline register and be written to whatever register guest D is at that time. And the question is, where does that guest D come from? Well, it comes from this pipeline register. So before it goes through the pipeline register, it's going to come from here. So these two values here, we can think of as a pair. This is a value plus where it is written. And we have a similar pair from after the pipeline register, which is how I infer that there's a pair. So after the pipeline register, we have a value where it's being written. Before, we have this a value where it's being written that becomes that. And so we have this eval e here, and if I want to figure out where it's being written, it's on this wire here. So then the question is, well, what is that wire going to be named? Well, if we think of our naming convention, it has to start with an E, because that's how we name the inputs and outputs of our pipeline registers in the execute stage. And we have one candidate for that here that isn't something else, and that's E dest D. Would it make sense for this to be called dest D? Well, it would make sense to call it dest D in the W stage, right? Probably a good name for this output here would be capital W dest D, because, you know, that's the only thing that makes sense to call dest D in the writeback stage. So probably this is little E dest D is the input that becomes W dest D. So I think C is the answer I would get. And a way I like remembering this is that, you know, we're sending values from one pipeline stage to another, and our value is always going to be paired with the other information for the instruction, which includes where it's going. So our destination register should be part of the same stage. So if we're taking a value from execute, which we are, this eval is from execute, it's just computed from the ALU, then to know where it goes, we need to look at another value in execute, because we're sending those values together through the pipeline. That the way we find that out is it came from the same instruction that's in that execute stage. And all the other candidates besides something else here are using something from the wrong stage, which must be from a different instruction. So the values in the writeback stage would be from some hypothetical instruction before add Q. You know, that's not where we want to figure out, you know, what this value that came out of the ALU is for. And the values from the decode stage are values from instruction to itself. That's not going to help us figure out what's happening in the execute stage. Questions? How I figured that out? Yes? Question is the value of reg source A passed to the pipeline registers? Not in this diagram. So the value of reg source A is whatever is on this wire here. And basically we're just taking, like making an extra wire from there and sending it to the control logic for this box. Does that answer your question? So, but I guess you could say that in this case, it comes from a pipeline register. Like it's the same as the output of one of the fetch to the code pipeline registers, but that may not always be true.
Other questions, follow-ups? Thought I saw someone back there. Maybe not. And this shows us a pattern where, you know, a way we're going to do a lot of control logic is we're going to keep track of where values are going and look at that information to figure out what we want to do. In this case, to figure out if we went to forward, we look at where is the value going that's in the execute stage, and that tells us if we're interested in it. And this is a reason why earlier on I said when we were making our pipeline, I was going to put computing destination registers in the decode stage. And the reason I did that is because, well, now that's really handy for implementing this control logic to have that already computed, not need to like recompute it all the time. So in the case of our add processor, this didn't really come up because the operation of computing the destination register was just use RB. But in our real processor, of course, that's a little more complicated. We want to do it early so we don't have to keep redoing it. Questions on register indices. Okay, so now we have forwarding, and forwarding is a lot better than stalling. So with stalling, our timeline, when we had these two dependent instructions, we had these two wasted cycles for stalling, and only then could we actually send the value. We needed to wait to decode until after the writeback. Now, it seems like we need no waiting. We just take the value from execute, send it to replace a value we just read that was wrong. And I alluded to earlier that, well, I showed you one forwarding path. Well, there's going to be some others we could implement. So on our full processor, for example, there's a forwarding path I can implement. I can take the value from memory's output, and I can send it directly to replace a register value I just read. I can also take this value from writeback to replace it, or a value from memory that was computed in the previous cycle from the ALU to replace it. I have a whole lot of options. I can take a value that's about to be written ALU. So they have a whole lot of forwarding paths I can implement. We're gonna go through some more specific examples. And I'd say, okay, so we can just do this all over. And there's some limitations. We can't just forward all over the place. So for example, this is not a forwarding path we can implement. So I'm saying, gosh, wouldn't it be nice if we could take the output of the memory and just send it right into the ALU box here? Why can we do that? And that is not a valid forwarding path. And the reason why it's not a valid forwarding path, like what's the reason we can't do this? Well, physically we can do it. So physically, I can't, you know, what this is asking me is I can put a box here. I can take in the signal that comes out of the data memory. I can implement the control logic for that box to decide when that value is the one we want, when it isn't. So I can physically implement this, but it's going to be a bad idea. So why is it going to be a bad idea? What's going to be wrong with it? Anyone? So by implementing forwarding, what are we hoping to do? What's the hope? What do we hope the result of adding forwarding is? Yeah. Resolving data hazards. Okay. Anything? Any other things? So we could already resolve data hazards with stalling. So why would forwarding be better? Fewer cycles. So we're going to take fewer cycles. And, well, if we did this forwarding, we would take fewer cycles than the alternative. But important to keep in mind that when we're talking about taking fewer cycles, like, we have to think of the whole picture. And what we actually want to do is improve our throughput. And our throughput wasn't typically measured in cycles, it was measured in time per instruction. And that includes both how many cycles and what our cycle time is. So we need to think about, how does this affect our cycle time? And remember, the way we computed cycle time is we looked for our critical path. And if I do this forwarding, here's my new critical path. Now, in one cycle, because I have this MUX here that's sometimes going to be taken, I need to read from the memory, data memory, and do an ALU computation. And if you think about this, well, we put the executed memory stages as separate, so probably we didn't want to do both of these in one cycle. This is probably going to be really long, and it's probably going to dramatically increase our cycle time. So yes, we can implement this forwarding, but it's going to hurt our performance overall, because even though we're saving cycles, we're making each of those cycles much longer. And we're only occasionally saving cycles. We're making all of our cycles much longer. So that's not something we're going to do. So there's lots of options for what forwarding we can do, but we need to be careful that our forwarding doesn't increase our critical path. Now, if you look at our sort of original forwarding case, you might say, well, did this increase our critical path much? And it may have increased our critical path because, well, we added a MUX. That's going to be on our critical path, but that's just one MUX. That's a relatively minor cost, and that is almost always going to be worth the increase in cycle time because of how many times we'll save whole cycles. But when we're talking about doing something where we're clearly, you know, very dramatically increasing our cycle time, and in particular where we're increasing our cycle time in a way which kind of defeats the point of separating executed memory into separate stages in this case, you know, it doesn't really make sense. Questions about forwarding we can't do? Okay. So the thing we want to think about is, you know, we don't want to increase our cycle time. Otherwise, we have lots of options to do forwarding. It turns out our textbook doesn't even do all of them, as we'll talk about a bit later. But you know, that's our main consideration, is that we can't dramatically increase our cycle time. And even in our simple add example, we're going to have some other forwarding that's going to make sense to do. So in what I showed you before, we had R9 used immediately after. It could also be used a cycle after. In which case, we have the same issue that, well, we've computed 1700, we're still going to read 900 because it hasn't been written yet. But we want to forward the value that's being written this cycle to replace the value with this just read. So we're going to do that by adding to those MUXs. So adding more forwarding paths. And in our full processor, we're going to have sort of lots of options for this. Sorry. Let me go through sort of this example here of like some not weird looking assembly code. So first, we have add R8 into R9. And then we have a subtract that uses R9. So to get the value for that subtract, well, we're going to want to have it at the end of decode. So simplest thing is I can forward it from the end of adds execute to the end of decode. We've seen this path before. Then I also have R9 used by that R move queue. And even though that R move queue is pretty far away, it turns out with our 5-stage pipeline that, well, it hasn't actually been written yet. So if we don't do anything, we're going to read the wrong value. We still have a data hazard. So our solution for that is going to be that I'm going to take the value from the write-back stage and forward it to the decode stage. Or the decode stage to give us the correct value. For this subtract, I have R11 from the subtract being used to compute an address. I need to have it replace the value of R11 we'll read, so that's another forwarding from execute to decode. And that value of R11 is also needed for the RWQ instruction to compute an address. So we're going to have, in fact, two values forwarded to this RWQ. It's not going to use any of the values it reads from the registers. And then we have, this XOR here, which uses the value from R10. So we're going to try to have that replace the value just read. In this case, I'm getting it right after it's read from memory. So this is actually the earliest I can forward it. And finally, we have a dependency you might have noticed, which is R9 from the beginning to the end. There's a dependency here, but this actually isn't a data hazard because I've written it at the end of cycle 4. I'm naturally reading it during cycle 5, so I don't have to do anything special. Just go forward and read. Sort of questions on all the forwarding that happens in this example. So we have lots of possibilities for forwarding. And something that's notable is that often we'll have multiple options. So for example, here I have value R8 used in all three add instructions, and this third add, well, if we're looking for the value of R8 here, I could get it from the first one. I could forward it from its memory stage. I don't want to do that because that's the wrong value of R8. That if we're thinking of running these instructions by hand, you know, the value I'm going to use to figure out what R12 plus R8 is the one I computed in the second add, not the first add. So I better get the value from the second add, not the first add. So even though we're going to have machinery to forward here, forward from the memory to decode in that case, we want to use the forwarding from execute because that's the instruction that's most recent. That's what we want to forward from. So if we're thinking about implementing this in HCLRS, you might say, does this mean I have to add some extra conditions to all my muxes in addition to that logic we showed earlier? And this explains why when we talked about muxes, the way they work is they evaluate in order. So by ordering our conditions appropriately, we can avoid this, you know, choosing the wrong forwarding. So what we'll do in this case is we'll put the execute condition first. So the execute will be chosen instead of the memory if the execute's acceptable, rather than us needing to write, if reg source A is equal to the value in memory and the value in execute's not acceptable, we don't need to say that explicitly, we just need to order things to make sure the right one gets priority. But we actually do need to be careful about that because it does matter. We're going to compute the wrong answer if we take the value from the first add instead of the second. Questions about a case where we have multiple options? Okay. We also can have instructions where both register values are forwarded. So in this case, the first add is where we get the value of R8. The second add is where we get the value of R12. And that's actually pretty free because we're going to implement the muxes for both. It just happens that sometimes you won't choose to use any of the values you read from the register file. Okay. So, yes?
So, forwarding has always been in the same kind of like cycle, so you can't go from cycle 3 for one of them to.
Question is, when we're forwarding, is always in the same clock cycle? And yes, because otherwise we're going in time. Now, it doesn't mean that we're using the value that's forwarded right away. So for example, in our earlier example here, I had a value forwarded of R9 from add queue to remove queue, but I didn't use it until memory, right? But when I actually sent it to the other instruction, I couldn't travel in time. So I needed to send it to the decode stage. Does that answer your question? So we've talked about sort of a bunch of options for forwarding. Let's look at this here. So I have code asking what forwarding, which have some, maybe not all the forwarding that happens, but which of these forwarding happens here? These three instructions. Who would like some more time? Let's just start with the first one. So, in subqueue, R8 is in which of our options? Who thinks A, not forwarded from? Thinks B, forwarded from execute. C, from memory. D, from write back. No clue. So most people got A, and here we say, oh, subtract uses R8. Yes, it does. It needs to read the right value of R8. And we think of where that comes from. Well, it doesn't come from the add because the add doesn't change it. So if we're reading a value of R8, either the value we're reading from the register is already correct, in which case we don't need to do anything, or the correct value is produced by an earlier instruction, and we probably should get it from there rather than from F. An earlier instruction that hasn't written back yet, I should say. Like perhaps whatever instruction is above the app. Questions on that? So let's do XOR. An XOR R9 is blank for NQ, who thinks A, not forwarded from. Cool. Thinks B, forwarded from execute. Okay. Thinks C, forwarded from memory. Thinks D, forwarded from write back. Okay, so most people said forwarded from memory, and I would concur with that. So if we think of, we're forwarding to the code according to the question. So yes, we could forward to other places. We could forward to like the beginning of execute, but that's not what the question's assuming we implemented, assuming the only forwarding to the code. So in that case, what we're saying we're doing is we have an arrow sort of ending here, and it has to come from the add, so it comes from memory. Because we aren't traveling in time, we have to forward in the same cycle, because if we're going between cycles, we're going through pipeline registers. Okay, so questions, not answer? Okay, so let's do this one. So MQ R9 blank add Q thinks A, not forwarded from. B, from execute. C, from memory. D, from write back. Okay, so most people figure out correctly, not forwarded from this. So this is a case where we had multiple forwarding paths that were possible. So we need to get the value of R9, and it's written by add and XOR. We could get it from add, but it would be the wrong value. We would get a value of R9, but not the right one. So the one we went to get is going to be from XOR. So for XOR, does it come from, who thinks, from execute? Or, sorry, for NQ, R9 is blank XOR. So who thinks, A, not forwarded, somewhere else. Thinks B, from execute. C, from memory. D, from write back. Okay, so we have pretty good consensus that it's from execute, because we're drawing this line here, comes from E to D. Questions on this exercise in general? Yes? Question is, when we're forwarding, do we always forward to the decode stage? Is that the question? So in this exercise, we're assuming that, and that's what our text will implement. We could hypothetically have decided that we're going to have a design where we place these muxes in different places and don't do that. So for example, one option would be that we could say that rather than having muxes there, we'll have a mux here and we'll send the values, you know, that way. That's the thing we could implement. That's not our textbook's design. We could implement combinations. This is not our textbook design, and obviously some of those would be redundant, and you know, it wouldn't make sense to implement that mux I just drew here and the other one at the same time, right? That wouldn't make sense. I'm generally going to be following, you know, assuming our textbook's idea that, you know, our main forwarding is going to be to the code right after the values are read, because that's going to avoid missing opportunities to forward. In some opportunities to forward, in particular, we need to forward from write back sometimes to decode, in which case we better be not waiting until later, right? We need to do that. But we'll see later that there would be cases where you might say forwarding to decode is not enough. And we'll look at some examples of those. But for the most part, forwarding to decode is gonna be probably enough to solve our problems with a few exceptions. So we have forwarding. I guess I should say, any more questions before I move on? Because I definitely should move on before if you want more questions. Okay. So talk about forwarding, and there's one type of forwarding we might want to do that won't work. So here I have an arrow move queue.
I'm taking a value right from RAX, is memory, the memory at RAX, putting it in RBX, and I'm then using RBX. And I'd like to take that value, which is not available to the end of the memory stage, and use it for the subtraction. But if we think of, like, the earliest we can do forwarding is the end of the memory stage, the first place I can put it is the end of XQ, which is too late. So I have a problem. And our solution to this problem is we're gonna do some stalling. But we're not gonna stall, like, all the way until it's written to the registers. We're just gonna stall long enough that we can forward. So, sort of what I'm drawing here is I say, okay, we're gonna run our subtract normally, and then in the subtract decode, we're gonna text, gosh, I'd really like to forward the value of RBX from our MR move queue, but I can't do that, so I'm just gonna try this decode again next cycle and stall all the instructions behind it. So our intuition is we try to forward, we realize, can't do it, and we just stall instead until we can forward. But we're still gonna do forwarding, because that's a lot better than waiting until another couple cycles for the value to be written to the registers. Questions about this resolution? Yes.
Yeah, but supplies are dropped that you can't. Because if you're moving it to the end of the XQ stage in the original, and you try, doesn't it only matter until you like write it to memory?
Question is, why can't I do this forwarding path here?
Yeah.
And that's because if I'm doing it to the end of the execute stage, like this is after my ALU, right? It's too late. Right, I'm forwarding it, trying to replace the value after I've done the ALU operation. Can't use it in the ALU. Can do the subtraction. If your proposal is to do it before the ALU, then this is exactly this long critical path you'd be adding. Right, because you'd be sending the value before the ALU, and have to go through the ALU after going through the data memory in one cycle. And that wouldn't work. Does that answer your question? So why we can't do the original proposed forwarding path? Other questions? Okay, so from this, you might say, okay, this means that anytime I have a value I load, and then I do anything with it, we're gonna stall. And that's what our textbook design does, is that it says, you know, anytime we load a value and then try to use it right away, we can't forward it, so we're gonna stall. This is maybe not actually quite what you need to do, because as someone pointed out, we can forward to places other than the end of decode. So in our textbook, they only forward to the end of the decode stage. And this misses one opportunity for forwarding in the five-stage design. And that's that if we load a value and then store it right away somewhere else, we can forward that value from memory to execute in this case without any stalling. And real processors that implement a pipeline like the one described in our textbook often implement this forwarding path to avoid stalling in this case, because it turns out people write assembly code like this quite a lot. But our textbook doesn't implement this. Our textbook only forwards the end of the code, so our textbook solution is that this case is handled the same as this one, even though that's not strictly necessary, because we can, you know, if we don't need to do any computation on the value, we can just forward it later.
Yeah.
So questions on sort of this special load to store case? Yes. Question, in this case, we didn't have to do anything with ALU, so we could just send it from memory to execute. Yes, note that we didn't have to do anything to RBX with the ALU, that this instruction is still doing something with the ALU, but it's doing it with RCX. But if we had to forward RCX, then we probably would still need to stall. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So let's do a little exercise. Here, so I have some code, assembly code here. So first question is, where are dependencies between these instructions? Which of them are hazards, and what which are resolved with forwarding, what type of forwarding? So forwarding, where do we go? Okay, so let's start with, who can tell me a dependency? Any dependency. Okay, so you're saying this I remove Q writes to RCX, this add Q reads from it. That's a dependency. I agree. Any other dependencies? There are some more. Yeah. Okay, so you're saying the first, last add queue and the first add queue. So remember dependencies versus hazards. So dependency is not the same as a hazard. So when we're talking about dependencies, we don't need to worry about how the pipeline works. So dependency is a property of the instructions themselves. Instructions, and the hazard is a property of the instructions plus the pipeline. So you've correctly identified a dependency. Doesn't matter what the pipeline is. That is a dependency. And indeed, you're correct. Whether it's a hazard or not depends on what our pipeline looks like. We should talk about that later, because that's the next, a later question. Okay. Any other dependencies? Yeah. Okay, between the last two add queues, yeah. So the second to last add queue writes our 10, then it's red by the next one. Okay. So I believe this is all the dependencies. Some people may have wanted to say, oh, sub queue writes RCX and our move queue uses RCX, and yes, that's true, but our move queue doesn't care what RCX was before. So that's not a dependency. But our move queue shouldn't change how it executes depending on what the previous value of RCX was. So those are our dependencies. So then the question is, which of them are hazards? And to figure out what they're hazards, some alluded to earlier, that, you wanted to look at like how far things were on the pipeline. Okay, so let's do that. So we're gonna have our first add, second, we'll just write out, assuming there's no stalling, which it turns out we won't need in this case. We can say, okay, so when this finishes up, I wrote these out, so I can't actually do this. Okay, let's be careful. So we'll have fetch, decode, and then fetch, and execute, and then decode, and then fetch, memory, and then execute, and decode, and then fetch, and write back, and memory, and execute, and then decode and fetch. So we can see that when the first add writes back its result is while the second add is fetching, therefore when the last add decodes, that's not gonna be a hazard because it's reading the value after it's written. There's no problem there. All of the other cases, when we look at our pipeline, it's going to be the case that, we're trying to read the value before it's been written. So, I guess I should here. So, in this case of this first instruction and the last one, the first instruction writes here, and the last one reads after that, so there's no problem. In the case of the other dependencies, like from the IRMOVEQ, we want to read the value before the IRMOVEQ has used it, so we're gonna have to do some forwarding for that. Or something else like that to resolve the hazards. It turns out forwarding will be sufficient there. And similarly, between our last two instructions, to get our 10, we're gonna have to do some forwarding. So we're going to forward the value of R10 from one to the other. I will write. Some questions. Figure it out. So what are hazards? All but RBX are hazards. And all hazards. And this example resolved for. So questions, I figured that out. Okay, so I alluded to that for figuring out hazards, we need to care about what the pipeline looked like, and a different pipeline might have different hazards. So for example, with a 5-stage pipeline, having this add instruction and this and instruction have a hazard because, you know, we're not writing back the value of our rate until the and is reading, until before the and reads it. Or sorry, until after the and reads it, yes. Because we're in write back, so we haven't written it yet when the and is reading it. With a four-stage pipeline, let's say we combine execute and memory, then we'd end up not having hazard. And similarly, if we add stages, we're likely to make things that weren't hazards before into hazards. So let's do an example here where we have a six-stage pipeline. So I'm saying I've split execute into two stages, and the assumption is that, well, if I need the result of the ALU operation, I can't get it to the second execute stage, because otherwise, why did we bother splitting it into two stages? Or presumably, it's because the ALU takes too long. And I have some code here, and my question is, where do forwarding and stalls occur? Good first step for this would be to figure out the dependencies that might require forwarding or stalling. I have this value of R9. It's a dependency for, no, not that one because I'm paying attention. Then dependency that way. Also have the value of RBX. Okay. Can someone tell me what happens with the second instruction? Just the second instruction. So, second instruction, I can see so far that it needs R9, which the first instruction computes. How is that going to happen? Someone? Yes, back there. Okay. So you're saying we need to stall once to wait for the first instruction to finish E2. So the way we can think about that is that we're going to try to get the values, and then we're going to realize, not available yet. Then we're going to wait, and then we can forward them. So we're following the pattern we saw earlier for like getting a value from memory. Same kind of principle applies. I like say, can I get? I really like to forward the value of 09, but it's not available yet. I'm going to stall, waiting for that to be available, and then I'm going to get it. And that's okay. So that's sort of the principle we're going to apply. So if we move on to the third instruction, well, the earliest it can actually read registers is cycle 4. And my question is, can we get the right register values then? Well, we're not going to read R9 naturally because it hasn't been written yet, but we can forward it. So that's presumably what we're going to do. And then we can execute normally. Questions? And I figured out those first three instructions. Okay. So I have this more worked out. Now, so we did the stalling, and now everything is delayed. And I had my second case of forwarding for this R9 dependency from here to here. Then I have to look at R9 going to the RM move queue. It turns out that's going to be interesting. So this R9 here needs to get to the RM move queue. And one thing we could do is we could say, okay, well, I can't read it here because it hasn't been computed yet. So we could stall for that. Or we could do the same trick I told you about doing from load to store and say, well, this is a value we're storing in memory. We don't actually need it until here. So let's forward it just in time for us to need it. Or possibly we could achieve the same effect by forwarding it like here. But we could implement a forwarding path for that. This is not something our textbook implements. So this is sort of textbook design would stall instead. Stall first. Step. So this is what I think, if you were implementing a processor with this pipeline, I think you would implement one of these extra forwarding paths because it's so much faster. But our textbook design doesn't do that. It only forwards the end of the code, so it would stall instead. And then forward. And our last instruction, there's no dependency, so it just happens right after this. So questions, how I answered this? So I guess I'm out of time, so next time we're going to talk about control hazards, which are, well, how do we deal with conditional jumps where we don't know whether the condition is taken yet?